Hey, welcome back to the COVID Response Project. I'm Matt Shapiro, the host of the project, and today we are joined by Ethan from Ohio. Ethan, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name's Ethan. I'm here in Stark County, Ohio, which is northeastern Ohio, just south of Akron. I work in finance and treasury. I'm 29 and lived in this area most of my life. This area is, say, pretty standard suburban Ohio. Having traveled through a lot of the state, a lot of the country, we're just kind of in the middle of it all. We've definitely neither too hot nor too cold. There's a couple big cities. It's a really nice mix of everything. I love living here. It's a beautiful country, 10 minutes from farmland, but 10 minutes from a real city and nice restaurants too. So it's home. And I'm excited to be talking about with you here tonight.
So tell me about, let's start with the sort of the early days of the pandemic. When did things start closing? What closed first? What were sort of the first signs of COVID in the early days?
So Ohio's orders came in effect March 16th. And I only remember that because the last normal event I remember going to is my mother's birthday on the 14th. And we all kind of knew at that point, things were coming down the pipe, things were going to have to change. And even at the time, there was like a debate my wife and I had, should we go? We just had a new baby. We wanted everybody to get to see her. And we also knew the world was changing. So as of the 16th, that's when all the official stay at home orders hit. That's when I think most employers shut their doors, and went to the remote work. So the formal, when everything formally hit, when the governor's orders came through, is really when everybody changed behavior. It was practically overnight here. I didn't see a lot of preparatory or anticipatory behavior changes until it was required.
Okay. So with masks, when did masks start really kind of coming in? When did you guys have a mask mandate? When did it start? When did it end? All that sort of stuff.
I'd have to look when I actually first obtained a mask. I don't think it was mandatory from the outset, though, because I remember the way we initially obtained masks was one of the ladies at church offered to sew them for anybody who wanted them. Mm-hmm. But it was not as soon as we went remote. I would guess it was at least a couple weeks into this thing. It was not something that hit overnight. It was not something that, again, I didn't see anybody wearing a mask before there were formal mask orders. And even once there were formal orders in place here, it was a matter of several weeks, if not months, before compliance was particularly good. Through a lot of even the early summer, very, very inconsistent, probably only 80 or 85% compliance there until the governor made a really heavy additional push as cases were starting to really surge.
So at this point, do you have a mask mandate, and what sort of compliance do you have, both indoors and outdoors?
So outdoor masking has never really been a thing here. It's actually been kind of wild for me as it seems like we're getting to the end stages here. I saw an article, and I think it was The Atlantic the other day, that said, is it time to get rid of outdoor mask mandates? And I had to do a double take because, I mean, granted, this is suburbia, so you're not like passing people on the street, that kind of thing. But I don't know that I've ever worn a mask outside other than we went to, there's like a food truck event. We wore masks to that because it was a little bit more crowded. But outdoor mask mandates have never been a thing. Compliance now, I'd say, is really pretty good. Most of Ohio's stuff lost the force of law. I believe it was in like January where it went from a formal health order to like an advisory thing, but it really didn't change much in terms of people's behaviors. Even now, I'd say you're at 95% of people wearing masks. Now, of that, probably 20% are not wearing them correctly. You see lots of exposed noses or even people just like wearing them around their chins just to say they have one, which is its own thing. But I would say even now, it hasn't had the force of law in a while, but every business I can think of still has a mask mandate. And the one instance of a local diner here that has very much fought the masking orders is the exception, not the rule.
Mm. Okay. So what has happened with schools? Did you guys shut them down back in March? And what's been the school situation for the 2020-2020 the 2021 school year?
So I wasn't super close to the schools in the spring. My wife's a teacher, but of course she was on maternity leave through the spring, which is perfect timing. But my mother's also a teacher, and they went fully remote immediately in the spring. And I don't recall any in-person instruction resuming in the spring, but come fall, outside of the big cities in Ohio, pretty much every district at least had an in-person option from day one. The big policy difference was how and when kids were able to switch from in-person to online. So some districts they had to elect on a 9 weeks basis, other was it was a semester basis. One district actually allowed you to come and go as you please, basically, because the parents wanted that convenience, but only in the big cities. So near here, that's Akron. Cleveland would be the other next bigger city. They were fully remote all the way until I think it was January, February, when the governor tied vaccinations being provided to teachers early to you have to have in-person instruction. I believe it was by March. So that forced the hand of those biggest city school districts. But at least in this area, I'm not aware of any districts that have been 100% remote the whole time.
What about how has it been for religious gatherings? Are people meeting in person?
Yeah, I think pretty much all churches were fully remote from, call it March through at least June or July, and you started to see a trickle back at that point. Fully masked or outdoor services, lots of parking lot gatherings, those kind of things. It's like our own congregation. We were back in person, masked indoor services with a streamed component as well for those who wanted to stay home. And I think a lot of congregations did something similar where maybe 15, 20%, 30% of the congregation at most was in person. Everybody else stayed home. And to some extent or another, most congregations have maintained that. Our own actually went back fully remote as things surged really heavily in October, November. And then we kind of went back to what we're doing. You're seeing congregations now that are actually introducing mask optional services. You're starting to see people who are actually, I don't want to say choosing a congregation, but they're traveling from one place to another to be in a masking environment that's of their preference. So I've heard stories of people both seeking out congregations that don't require masks for services, as well as people who are not attending where they normally would because they want to be in a place where mandatory masking is. So it's been interesting to
Interesting.
see those shifts, but to my awareness in Ohio, there haven't been any high profile conflicts as you saw. And I think Louisiana had a pretty high profile conflict where the state was having to enforce things and it got really dicey. None of the big lawsuits that other states have had that I'm aware of.
As for restaurants and bars, have things changed in a semi-permanent way over there? Are there any restrictions on them at this point?
It'll be interesting to see how much things stick. Pretty much everywhere went to having a takeout and or curbside option, as I think is the case in most of the country. Our restaurants were able to open up for some in-person service probably early fall. And it's actually almost humorous, some of the way that they've adapted to this, because they've made a big deal about some of the what I would call hygiene theater, so the scrubbing and cleaning. But also you see lots of restaurants that have these plastic dividers up. They'll use PVC or plywood and clear plastic to put up, whether it's between a booth or to make these, like, it reminds me of the vice presidential debate or some of those kind of things where it's like a clear screen as if that helps block the aerosols, which I'm no epidemiologist, but I'm suspecting that the PVC and shower curtains are not doing a whole lot to prevent disease transmission. That's just my guess.
Oh, well. So But you would say there are no restrictions on, are people going to restaurants? Are they full or are they?
Up until recently, they weren't particularly full. There were formal capacity restraints when they first reopened, something like 30%, or it was some arbitrarily low number. I think at this point it's become at the whatever the restaurant's comfort level is. So of course, my wife and I were fortunate to be fully vaccinated pretty early. So when we've gone out, you'll see restaurants that have the tables marked, this table closed for social distancing, that kind of thing. But even now, I think most restaurants are still doing some stuff. All the staff are fully masked all the time. They ask you to wear a mask until you're seated, that kind of thing. In driving past restaurants, I feel like if things aren't back to normal, they're probably 80 or 90% of normal, at least by the car traffic. We've been in restaurants a handful of times since we were vaccinated and didn't feel quite normal, but it's closer than I would have actually expected at this point, given where the vaccination programs are. I think a lot of people have just decided they're done and they want to enjoy things again.
Right. Okay. The last big one is movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
How has the pandemic impacted them? Are they closed? Are they open? What's going on?
Mm-hmm. So in this area, we have, I believe, two or three Regals and probably two or three Cinemarks that are within, call it, a half hour driving distance of where I'm at. The Regals very briefly reopened, maybe less than a month, and then shut again and are not on track to reopen here for another 4 or 5 weeks. The Cinemarks reopened in the fall, and they've been doing the private viewing parties and whatever movies have been out, and stayed open the whole time. I've seen two or three movies, got to see Tenet in theaters with like five people in the theater, which was great. They're doing mandatory seating spacing. So when you book your seats, your party has to sit all together, and then they book two seats on either side, and the rows are more than 6 feet apart from one to the next. So it's honestly a really great experience. they make a big advertising push about all the cleaning and sanitization they're doing, but I figure as far as indoor activities goes, that's about as safe as it's going to get given the distancing. And I think people have been pretty good, as much as you can tell in the dark, pretty good about wearing the masks and not using the popcorn loophole, as it were.
Right. So what other things do you think are maybe unique to Ohio there, or that you've noticed in particular? I know you wrote a little bit about the state guidelines, the governor's decision making, and specifically the dashboard, which I was very curious to read about that. Tell us a little bit about that.
I knew that one would be catnip for you, just being a data visualization thing. It's been interesting for me. Ohio is now deemed a red state, and I think the political culture around COVID's been really interesting because Mike DeWine is a Republican. He is, I think in normal times, you'd call him a centrist Republican.
That's your governor.
Yes. Yeah. And he pretty early on, I think, made a name for himself nationally as being one of the red state governors who was taking this thing seriously, made a big deal of publicly communicating and trying to follow best practices, which my early read on his approach to this was certainly appreciation. He was trying to do the right thing. And I think most people were willing to at least give him the benefit of the doubt early. Now, obviously, some people who have decided that either COVID's not real or that they just don't want to deal with all this soured on him very quickly. I think there's still a contingent who's very, very loyal to him and very, very grateful for everything he's done. I think that the majority opinion, though, has shifted to frustration, as Mike DeWine is very credulous about the direct linkage between the policies he enforces or suggests and the results on the ground. So when Ohio's numbers have stabilized, he's said, well, we need to be pushing, we need to be doing this, we need to be doing that. And you can tell he very much believes that the communications and the policies and the levers of government, as it were, have a big impact on what happens on the ground. And I know that you're at least somewhat skeptical of that. I've developed more skepticism of that as it's all gone on. And Mike DeWine is he believes in what he's doing, which is probably he's in the right job for that. I think that generally people have become somewhat tired, especially of some of the tinkering around the edges, as Ohio started to ease into normalcy. The thing that made everybody just very frustrated was there's a curfew. Which to me, the utility of a curfew is questionable at best. If you're trying to close bars, close bars.
Right.
But instead, the curfew was tied to hospitalization rates. So the joke that people would tell is, well, does COVID only spread after a certain hour, or do we somehow get safer as there's lower hospitalization that we're allowed out later? I mean, I'm not aware of anybody who changed their behavior as a result of the curfew. So I think it was more theoretical, but those kind of little tinkerings around the edges and the idea that we, at certain hospitalization rates, we could stay out to a certain time. It's just so facially ridiculous, and it undermines whatever good work there is to be done.
A lot of that, and a lot of those sorts of policies, and I'm sorry to interject myself in here, but a lot of those sorts of policies that kind of tie certain metrics to what people are allowed to do, they end up feeling like very paternal. Like you people are in charge of these hospitalization rates, and if you don't keep them down, then you're not going to get a, you know, get a treat at the end of the day. And that's kind of a weird attitude to have towards people.
And I think that underlying attitude, that paternal instinct, it's very much what characterizes Mike DeWine's communications. And I think that's what's grating on people. And even now, it actually ties into the data visualization to some extent, because currently Ohio has this, the map, the red alert system, I believe they've called it. And it's wildly complex. There's like 7 metrics that sit behind a 4-color scale. And if a certain number of these 7 metrics are tripped, you're yellow versus orange versus red versus purple. And I would bet if you surveyed 1,000 people in Ohio, maybe 3 of them could even tell you that much. I mean, it's absurdly complicated. But everybody there for a while was watching this very, very closely. Oh, we dipped into red. And you'd actually hear people talking, well, if we dip into red, what does that mean? Some of the schools would send surveys to parents. Okay, if we go to red, if we go to purple, what does that mean? So very early on, the system had a lot of attention, a lot of credibility, and it was absolutely burned to the ground here after the first of the year, because everybody knew that things were getting better. Hospitalizations were dropping, case counts were dropping, case positivity or test positivity was dropping. And for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, very, very few counties changed at all. The map went from basically solid red with a couple purples to solid red with maybe 1 or 2 fewer purples. It became very, very clear that the sensitivity going up actually felt pretty good, but the sensitivity to come back down, I guess one of the metrics to go out of red alert was to get cases below 100 per 100,000 residents, which just hasn't been met in something like probably 60 plus of Ohio's 88 counties have like, not gone below that this entire time.
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's been like 4 or 5 months almost.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the county I'm in right now, I believe the metric today is we're at 148 per 100,000. And I would guess we've been there plus or minus 20 for a month or two. And we're pretty much in the middle of the pack and have been for most of this thing. Which, by your reaction, is very, very high for around here. That's
No. Well, I don't want to get too much into the weeds because that's not what this particular interview is for. But it's just part of a general observation I've had that at the very beginning of this thing, people set their expectations for what they thought was going to be high and what they thought was going to be low. Mm-hmm. And if a state hasn't realigned over the last 6 months, then it's very, very hard to take it seriously.
I don't believe that the metrics under the hood on this have changed since its inception in probably August. I mean, we're talking about at least 6-8 months that I don't believe the underlying metrics have changed. And what's problematic and what's frustrating and where people like me are driven crazy is that this actually does affect policy on the ground, at least in regulated environments. Like my grandfather is in a nursing home. And even with us being fully vaccinated and being willing to wear a mask and this, that, and the other, we really had to fight to get in to see him. So we were able to physically go in and see him, but we had to make multiple calls and talk to a caseworker. And the fact that we were vaccinated and he was on hospice and he was widowed over the past year, we're all like, yes, you really do need to let us in. This is important to us. And I had to really fight the system for something that their vaccination rate on the facility is over 80%. He's fully vaccinated. He tested positive during this and he's fully vaccinated. Like the risk just isn't there. Heck, I would have bought an N95 happily for my wife and I to wear to go visit. And it's, but because we're in the red, they are terrified of being too permissive. And it's very clear their administrators are watching that metric. And I don't know what the exact incentives or risks are there for them, but that was very explicitly, so long as we're in the red, we cannot loosen policies. And that very simplistic, we're not going to get below 100 cases per 100,000 for a while yet. And that's the circuit breaker.
Right.
So to your point, we haven't realigned expectations, but now we're driving behavior on the ground. After 80% of the nursing home is vaccinated, over 50% of the population are vaccinated, that doesn't make sense. And that's the kind of frustration that it's hard to argue too much with people who are sick and tired of this stuff when there's very blatant, I don't want to call it injustices, but certainly unnecessary frustrations and roadblocks for people who are just trying to live a little bit of life and do a little bit of caring for people they love.
Right. There, I think a lot of the time you end up with a heavy preference for fidelity to the metric and not enough flexibility for the people beneath it, right? The people who are actually living and like in your case, where you have a very, very good reason and all of the externalities and all the conditions are there to make a good case for something, but the metric is the metric.
Yeah. And that's the nature of bureaucracy on some level. And that gets to a much deeper conversation. But this idea that, like you said, that doing the right thing, taking care of people, taking care of the residents, doing whether it's the right thing for kids in schools, it does feel like we've become so attuned to zero risk or what is the metric. And we've defined down what's important. And everything has to become about COVID. And that I don't know how we break that mindset of almost zero risk tolerance and zero willingness to actually weigh risk versus reward. That's been the single biggest thing that has come out of this to me, whether it's the Johnson & Johnson pause or some of these metrics and policy unwinds, is how are we going to get back to thinking about what's really important? What are we really trying to do here?
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, Ethan. And I will. Good luck to you, the wife, and the young baby.
Thank you.
And I hope things do calm down and we're back to normal fairly soon.
I certainly appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Matt.
Thank you.